The Sirens of Mars call to us this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. Georgetown University professor and planetary scientist Sarah Stewart Johnson has written a beautiful book she calls The Sirens of Mars, Searching for Life on Another World. We'll spend some time with her in a few moments, and we'll award a copy of the book to the winner of the new space trivia contest Bruce has cooked up for you this week. It's a nice coincidence that Mars is shining bright in the sky right now, and Bruce will tell you where to find it. Our sympathies and best wishes for a quick recovery go to everyone affected by last week's terrible storms in North America. Before Laura became a hurricane, it was a tropical storm that our own LightSail 2 snapped a picture of. That shot tops the August 28th edition of The Downlink, the Planetary Society's weekly newsletter that you'll find at planetary.org/downlink. As spectacular, or even more so, is the shadow of Japan's Hayabusa 2 spacecraft against asteroid Ryugu. This was minutes after the probe collected the first of two samples that are now speeding earthward. The James Webb Space Telescope passed a couple of important tests. We're now just over a year from its planned launch. And China is looking for partners. Russia and the European Space Agency have responded to calls for collaboration on a lunar base that could be visited by humans in the early 2030s. There's much, much more waiting for you in the Downlink with a new edition every Friday. Last week, we looked toward the end of the universe with Katie Mack. This time, we joined the search for life right next door. Sarah Stewart Johnson has written a wonderful book about humankind's fascination with the red planet for, oh, let's say forever, or at least since our ancestors noticed that red star wandering the sky. Speculation about life on Mars also goes back very far, but it's only in the last six decades that we have been visiting. Sarah is in the thick of our quest for Martian biosignatures, signs that life may have existed up there billions of years before it seems to have appeared on Earth. It has been a troubled search, full of wrong turns and disappointments, but now, with the rover called Perseverance and the beginning of sample return, we may be on the edge of a discovery that will shake our own world. All of this is chronicled in The Sirens of Mars, Searching for Life on Another World, published by Crown. The great writing reminds me of Sasha Sagan's For Small Creatures Such as We, which is a high compliment. Sarah is Associate Professor of Planetary Science at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., where her lab focuses on how we find and recognize life. She has been part of the teams behind the Spirit, Opportunity, and Curiosity rovers, and is a visiting scientist with the Planetary Environments Lab at NASA Goddard. I talked a few days ago with this former Rhodes Scholar and White House Fellow. Sarah, thank you very much for joining us on Planetary Radio, and thank you for this really lovely lyrical book, which I just so much enjoyed reading.
Oh, thank you, Matt, and thanks so much for having me.
You grabbed me right from the start of this book, not just because I love the story you tell about our search for and our fascination with life on Mars, but because of how well you tell it. In the book's prologue, you talk about a lake in the far reaches of Australia. Here's a quote from that. I'm going to read it. In the right place with a good grip, you can pull out a crystal of gypsum severed like a shark's tooth from the jaw of the earth. The spear-tipped blades are as large as your hand. When you rinse away the red mud and hold it to the light, it flashes in the sun like a gemstone. Under a microscope, you can see the tiniest of pockets within it, glinting drops of lake water sheathed in mineral hideaways, life caught in a crystalline dagger. Life caught in a crystalline dagger. That's how you caught me. It's beautiful. And of course, that's your theme in the book, this ongoing search for life on this other nearby world that is still far enough away that it's been a very slow process discovering more about it. Before we really get into the book, could you talk about a little bit about what you do at Georgetown, you and your lab?
Sure. So I'm a planetary science professor and an astrobiologist, and the focus of our lab is in biosignature detection. So looking for biosignatures or traces of life in planetary environments. And so part of what we do is we try to understand how these signatures of life can be preserved over time. And we go out to these analog environments, places here on Earth that bear relevant similarities to other planetary environments like the ancient terrain on Mars. And we really try to learn how to look and trying to test out different approaches and different techniques. But then a big part of the lab also is analyzing data from current spacecraft and trying to design concepts for future missions, for future instruments.
There is, of course, life as we know it, which is largely what we have been looking for on Mars. But I know that you also are fascinated by the search for life as we don't know it. Is that something that you're also working on?
Oh, it is indeed. We were funded by NASA for this project that we've been calling the Laboratory for Agnostic Biosignatures. And that's really what we're after, trying to find signs of life that don't presuppose any particular molecular framework or any specific underlying biochemistry. It's a big challenge because we have developed these incredibly robust ways to look for biosignatures that are associated with life as we know it. We can go out into the extreme environments here on Earth where there's very little life to begin with and use these techniques. We can use them to understand the earliest history of our own planet, looking at how certain types of molecules are preserved over geologic time. But what we're doing here is really looking for ways that we could detect things that are just really beyond the confines of our current thinking. And so looking for things like chemical complexity or energy transfer or accumulations of elements or isotopes that are really different from what you'd expect from abiotic processes alone. Sometimes it's it feels like trying to imagine a color that you've never seen before, but it's one of the most exciting things that my lab is working on right now. I feel like it's a great intellectual challenge, but it's also great fun trying to imagine what other types of life we could be looking for.
It is absolutely fascinating, something that we love to talk about on the show from time to time, because it does take us into such uncharted territory. I'm also thinking of an experience that you say in the book made you a planetary scientist. You were in Hawaii. It had to do with both the beauty and the tenacity of life.
Yes. I had this incredible professor named Ray Arvidson as an undergraduate at Washington University in St. Louis, and he took all of us in a class that he was teaching off to the Big Island of Hawaii on a field trip. There was this moment when we were exploring the summit of Mauna Kea, which is this huge volcano. And you drive up the side of the volcano and you pass the end of the tree line, you pass the last of the scrub, and you even have to stop to acclimatize for a few hours because the oxygen is so thin by the time you get to the very summit. And there are a lot of telescopes up there, but we were walking around this terrain, hiking about, and there's just nothing green in sight. You know, it looks almost like a crystallized bruise. It's all shards of black and gray and purple. And I was walking around kicking at some of those volcanic rocks. And at one point, one turned over and I saw that there was the smallest little fern that was growing there just against all odds. It was just the most tenacious, beautiful thing that I had seen. And it just seemed like that fern stood for all of us in this vast emptiness, this huge wasteland. There was just this tiny splash of life. And there really was something in that moment that I think made me become a planetary scientist, or just made this idea of searching for life in the universe make sense to me.
It's a striking moment, and obviously one that had great influence over you. So here we are, 2020. We've learned so much about the red planet, you know, going back to the times of Galileo through Schiaparelli and Lowell, and even the early days of Maria Zuber's career and Carl Sagan. Now we've got three more missions on their way to Mars, including Perseverance, the descendant of Curiosity, but the first to go back to the Red Planet since Viking, that will actually be headed there to actively look for life. This has got to be very exciting for you.
Indeed, it's like a watershed moment. You know, we had this lull 20 years after Viking, no Mars missions. And then we started back in the late 90s with this idea that we would follow the water. And then we just kept finding the water and finding the water and finding the water. And then the next step was to look for signs of habitability to really understand the context for life. And with the Curiosity rover mission, we've also definitively found evidence of ancient habitable environments, places that have the ingredients, the essential elements for life as we know it, as well as the building blocks, those kind of organic molecules from which a house of life can be built. Now we are finally moving back to actively looking for biosignatures. And so Perseverance is going to kick off this breathtakingly ambitious campaign to collect samples from Jezero Crater, this exquisitely preserved river delta there on the surface of Mars, and then bring them back to Earth for study in different laboratories to look for evidence of ancient life.
Awfully exciting, which is why we frequently talk about it on Planetary Radio. Let me ask you, both as a scientist and someone who feels what our boss calls the passion, beauty, and joy of all of this, if Perseverance does its job, maybe doesn't even have to wait for sample return, but maybe its microscope, after drilling down a little bit, finds something that looks an awful lot like evidence of past life, maybe microbial life on Mars, what will that mean to you and to science and to humanity?
Well, I have to say, I'm not getting my hopes up too high for the immediate primary mission, because one of the things that we could find, I mean, it would be incredible if we looked into some ancient terrain and we found something that looked like a stromatolite, you know, from this ancient lake. But even so, like I think about here on Earth, we are having huge debates over, you know, what is and what isn't life from the ancient rock record. And part of that is we have this overprinting of life and contamination, but we've really wanted to study those samples carefully to really be able to say definitively, okay, this was certainly life. It may be in many ways easier to find life on Mars because we aren't messing with the signals in the same way that we are here on Earth. We haven't swallowed so much of the ancient crust. Those rocks have not been metamorphosed. But getting back to your original question, if we were to find something that looked like a smoking gun, and especially once we had that back in our labs and we were able to confirm with multiple lines of evidence that this really looks like a real thing, I just think it would be one of the greatest discoveries in the history of modern science. We simply have one data point for life. All the life that we know of is exactly the same. It's this DNA-based stuff, carbon-based us. And if we had another data point, especially if it was a separate genesis, I just think that would be transformational. It would really get to so many of the fundamental questions we have about whether biology is just a consequence of energetic systems and how different biologies might come into being. And I also think it would just be another kind of Copernican revolution in terms of how we see our place in the universe.
Another Copernican revolution. All right, my fingers are crossed. I got just one more question for you. Before I ask you to read a particularly lovely passage from the last chapter of the book. And this question, really, it's a thread that has run through our conversation, runs through many conversations I have with researchers on this show. How is the story of Mars also a story about Earth?
Oh, I like that question a lot, Matt. You know, science, it's not just about the science. It never is. You know, our exploration of Mars is about our human relationship to the planet. And we have brought so much passion and ingenuity and drive and just yearning to the search for life that I think is so reflective of who we are as a curious species. And in many ways, that's why I wanted to write the book, because I just thought Mars needed a different type of treatment. There were just so many things that were poignant and beautiful and compelling about the endeavor that I just don't ever think would ever find expression on the pages of scientific journals. And there's just so much about the mystery and the wonder of this quest. And I guess that's what I hope I accomplished with the project.
I can assure you, speaking for myself, you absolutely did, and it is why I recommend this book so highly. Would you please take on reading this little passage that I sent you from the last chapter? Before you do, you're going to have to define one word, an ancient Egyptian term. Am I pronouncing this correctly? Akhet?
I think that's right. You know, we're not actually sure how it's pronounced because the vowels have been lost to history. It's just the hieroglyph from which we've reconstructed the word, just with its consonants. But this was one of the seasons. The ancient Egyptians, there would be the flooding, the repeated flooding of the Nile Delta. And as the waters would come in, there would be this moment, the end of Akhet, when the waters would recede and you would finally be able to have solid ground once again. The quote, which is from the final chapter of the book, it starts with, "What if life is a consequence of energetic systems? What if the nothing to something has happened time and again? And because of the chinks in our cavern are so small, we don't know it. For me, this is what the search for life amounts to. It is not just the search for the other or for companionship, nor is it just the search for knowledge. It is the search for infinity, the search for evidence that our capacious universe might hold life elsewhere, in a different place or at a different time or in a different form. That confirmation would be a rebuke to the cratered image of Mars, the acid waters, the sterile soil. It would stand in contradistinction to the finite life to which we are confined, to the finite planet we inhabit. Finding life, even if it is the smallest microbe, would, for me, be the end of Akhet. It would be the first dry mound emerging from the limitless dark water, an actual fact about the actual world, a truth, a beginning. It would be a shimmering hope that life might not be an ephemeral thing, even if we are."
Just beautiful, Sarah. Thank you so much for reading that and for giving us this book, The Sirens of Mars, Searching for Life on Another World, published by Random House, a division of Penguin Random House. And here's a word to the wise. If you stick around for this week's What's Up segment, Bruce and I will mention that you might win a copy of The Sirens of Mars in this week's Space Trivia Contest. Again, Sarah, thank you. Best of continued success as you continue your work there at Georgetown and across the void to Mars. And by the way, congratulations on achieving tenure at Georgetown University.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you. I really appreciate it. It was such a pleasure to chat today. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Sarah Stewart Johnson, planetary scientist, seeker of life, and newly published author of The Sirens of Mars, which you'll have a chance to win as we head into What's Up. As always, there's much more of my conversation with Sarah than we had time for here. The full interview is in the online edition of this week's show at planetary.org/radio. Back with Bruce in a minute. This is Planetary Radio.
Greetings, PlanRad listeners. Bill Nye, the Planetary Guy here. You and I know better than to ask if another world-shattering asteroid will come our way. The only question is when. Here at the Planetary Society, we're committed to protecting the planet. You can be a defender of Earth. We need you on our planetary defense team. It's the only large-scale natural disaster we can prevent. You can learn more about this work and how to join us at planetary.org/defendEarth. We're just trying to save the world.
Hi, this is Kate from the Planetary Society. How does space spark your creativity? We want to hear from you. Whether you make cosmic art, take photos through a telescope, write haikus about the planets, or invent space games for your family, really any creative activity that's space-related, we invite you to share it with us. You can add your work to our collection by emailing it to us at connect@planetary.org. That's connect@planetary.org. Thanks.
Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio, starring the chief scientist of the Planetary Society, that's Bruce Betts, who has, I haven't actually looked myself, but I'm told 6 different listings in the IMDb.
Yes, and they're missing a couple from blockbuster movies that I did.
All right, well, if that's a mystery to you why I brought this up, it won't be when we get to answering the contest this week, coming up with that. All will become clear, as is, I hope, the sky over your head tonight so that you can see the things that Bruce is going to tell us about.
Nice. Nice. Well played, sir. Yes, the evening, well, both evening and pre-dawn are glorious planet-wise. We've got Jupiter and Saturn up in the south in the early evening, Jupiter being the super bright object, Saturn to its left, looking yellowish. And also now, coming up in the early evening, we've got Mars getting brighter and brighter through early October. And it is brighter than any star in the sky, though still not quite as bright as Jupiter, looking reddish over in the east. And wait, if you look at it on September 5th, the evening of September 5th, the moon will be very close to it. If you happen to be in much of the central portion of South America, the moon will actually go in front of Mars. But if you're not, it won't. But it'll be very close. It'll be within a degree or two moon diameters for pretty much everyone who gets to see it. So that's September 5th. And then in the pre-dawn, you can't miss Venus. It's going to be getting lower over the coming weeks and months, but it's up there for a while and looking super bright in the east in the pre-dawn. We move on to This Week in Space History. I can't believe another year has passed for me to tell you, Matt. Hey, Star Trek, the original series, premiered this week in 1966.
Which is why this is known as Star Trek Day. So, I think our colleagues at the Society are going to be celebrating that in our social media.
Well, we have good friends out of the Star Trek universe.
Yeah. I think they're going to premiere a very cool video, which I won't talk about, but yeah, it's going to be such fun.
I would talk about it, but you would probably cut it out. So I will just say it is very, very nice. Very cool. And one more This Week in Space History. 1977, Voyager 1 launched. It's still going, and we'll talk a little bit more about it in just a moment as we get to Random Space Fact.
Oh, don't be sad.
I don't know what came over me. It's more of a happy emotion with Voyager. So every year, Voyager 1, as it heads out of the solar system, every year, Voyager 1 travels about 6 times the Earth to Mars' closest distance.
Just racing on out there. It's amazing.
Okay, let's move on to the trivia contest. I said, as of now, August 2020, what is our Matt Kaplan's one credit on IMDb, the Internet Movie Database? How'd we do, Matt? Was it weird for you?
It was, odd. It was decidedly odd. Before we get to the answer, here is all the wrong answers from Mel Powell in California. He said, before I looked it up, he made a list of guesses. 1, Enterprise Relief Communications Officer in Star Trek VI, Undiscovered Country. 2, M4PO, Random Background Droid at Mos Eisley. Or 3, Fido number 3, Uncredited in Apollo 13.
Were you any of those, Matt?
I was one of them. I won't tell you which one.
Oh, man. That'll be next trivia contest. All right. Keep going.
Here's the response from our poet laureate, Dave Fairchild in Kansas. Back in November of 2019, Matt and Mendoza were paired and worked on a mystery sighting of cats that took Fina quite unawares. In episode 6, a catastrophe came, and that's how it all came to be, that Matt has his name for a single event you can find in the IMDb. What the heck is he talking about there? It's the Fina Mendoza Mysteries. Yes, that got me a credit, much to my surprise, as you discovered 2 weeks ago when you posed this question. My very good friend for a million years, Kitty Feldy, author, playwright, actress, host, speaker. She wrote this book for kids, Welcome to Washington, Fina Mendoza. Kitty was also a Washington, D.C. reporter for many years and got to know D.C. very well. And it's about this young girl, Fina Mendoza, who is the daughter of a new congressman. And she gets involved in this mystery having to do with a cat in the Capitol building. It is a book. You can find it at kittyfeldy.com, a little plug there. And it is also, it's listed as either a TV series or a podcast. It's really more of a radio drama, an episodic radio drama. That's how I would describe it. It's great fun. And I do have this little part in it. I think I'm in episode 6. So there you go. That got me into the the prized IMDb.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Oh, I should tell you who won.
Well, that's why I was, you know, leaving some dead space for you to fill that in. Usually it's kind of a weird little tradition we've got.
It's a given. Leonard Soyka is given the prize this time around. Leonard in the state of Virginia. And he said he actually listened to episode 6 just to verify that I'm actually there. He made sure it was really me. It is. Leonard, he's a past winner, but it has been, get this, 4 years since he last won the contest. So congrats, Leonard. You are going to get a copy of the Backyard Astronomer's Field Guide, How to Find the Best Objects in the Night Sky, or the Best Objects the Night Sky Has to Offer, I should say, by David Dickinson. It's terrific. It's a loose leaf, as I said, when we introduced this, so that you can take it outside and the wind probably won't blow the pages over while you're looking up at the night sky. It's an excellent, excellent field guide. We're ready for another one.
What is the only spacecraft to launch with solar system escape velocity? So in other words, as it left Earth, it had enough velocity to escape the solar system. Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
So didn't have to pick up any more velocity from little flybys, yeah, right? And bouncing around other planets.
It was not required.
The prize, first of all, you have until the 9th, that's Wednesday, September 9th at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us the answer to this one. And the prize, should you have it right and be chosen by random.org, is the book that we were just talking with Sarah Stewart Johnson about, her book, The Sirens of Mars, Searching for Life on Another World, available from Crown. And it is as good as you heard me saying during that conversation. So good luck, everybody. And good luck to you, Bruce. Go after that 7th Internet Movie Database entry.
Well, you know, they're missing a couple. I'll work on that. All right, everybody, go out there, look up in the night sky, and think about what role Matt Kaplan may have played in The Lord of the Rings. Thank you, and good night.
I don't want to give any hints away. My precious. Actually, I was in a sitcom pilot, but it never went anywhere. It was
what?
Yeah, it's a story for another day. That's Bruce Betts. He's the chief scientist for the Planetary Society, who joins us here and in the IMDb every week for What's Up.
I'd watch your sitcom.
No, it kind of sucked. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its lively members. Mark Hilverda is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. Ad Astra.